And then I'd ask you, please help me welcome Jeff T. from Tehachapi as our guest speaker.
Hi, can you hear me? My name is Jeff from Tehachapi. And I'm delighted to be here and honored to be asked to do this, to participate. Oh, I'm alcoholic, yes, thank you. In this tie, I don't feel like one. But I assure you that shortly you'll know for sure I'm an alcoholic. Welcome, Blair. Glad you're here. Please come back. And you know, the sign of a great meeting is when you walk in and you feel like you belong here. And I tell you, from the gate, even before we got to the door, we were met by people who introduced themselves, and you had food here. So please come back. Come to another meeting. If you don't hear anything out of my talk, if you're looking for a deeply intellectual talk tonight, I would encourage you to go to another meeting. But, but I'm delighted to be sober. You know, we do a lot of praying in Alcoholics Anonymous, where I've come to do a lot of praying, and I did a lot of praying on the way here tonight. We just bought my wife a new sedan, so I was going between, she's a great driver, don't get me wrong, but I was going between the third step prayer and the serenity prayer a lot, and, but we made it. And I've been sober since December 25th, 1990, and I hope and pray that is always my sobriety date. And this is no indictment on anybody else, but when I came in here, I had to grasp at this, and I wasn't sure I was gonna make it. So I'm hanging on to that sobriety date at all costs. And what else was I getting? Oh, Tehachapi. I'm gonna tell you a little bit. Some of you had mentioned that you've driven through Tehachapi or perhaps stayed there when you were going to the Air Force Base or whatever. But we've been there about 5.5 years now, and we love it. We absolutely love it. There's about 13,000 people in the surrounding areas. There's about 30,000 people, and we've got 5 or 6 stoplights now. And so there's no such thing as a traffic jam anywhere. And we're members of the Tehachapi Mountain Group up there, and it's an umbrella group, meaning that 90% of the meetings are held in one room. It's not a Lano Club, nothing against that. But it's an umbrella group. So all these meetings are held in this one facility there. And it's great. We have 3 meetings a day, sometimes a little more. And one of the reasons we fell in love with it up there is we went up to check it out. And every day they have a literature study, usually at the noon meeting. So whether it be the big book, the 12-step, 12 tradition, as Bill sees it, daily reflections, whatever it is, there's always book studies to go to up there. And we have our own prison, which is nice for doing hospitals and institutions. And not a lot of people have this sacred vow, but Anita and I had this kind of a vow that when we got married, that someday we'd walk through the prison hand in hand carrying the message of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we've done that at the Sea Yard, which is general population. And it's a little cumbersome. You have to put a shank-proof vest on when you go in there, which is kind of like a flak jacket, right? But we both love and have done a lot of hospitals and institutions in our sobriety, and I love her. We've been married 20 years, and I usually say 19 of the best years of my life, but I'm not going to say that tonight. But sorry. But we both love Alcoholics Anonymous, and she works with a bunch of gals, and I work with a few guys, and it becomes a way of life. Like I stated before, I'm an alcoholic, and I discovered the effect produced by alcohol when I was, you know, probably when we were kids, after they'd have a poker party or something at the house, you'd go around and drink the rest of the cans of beer that are left out. My parents weren't big partiers, but they would entertain on occasion. And once in a while, you get a cigarette butt in there and just kind of spit it out. But the first, you know, there's nothing when you're like 8 or 9 years old. You get to take a few pulls off of a cold Budweiser or Pabst Blue Ribbon or one of those old. And it just kind of goes down your mouth. And you feel the cold. You just go, oh, that's great. I never felt the effect of those. It was, I think I was probably 10 or 11. My brother had a big wedding, and after the ceremony, I crawled underneath the champagne table, and I stayed there for the rest of the reception. And I have no idea how I got. I'm pretty sure my parents took me home that night, but I have no recollection of anything. So I think that was my first real drunk that happened. And I tell you, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I associated with other people who drank, like other juvenile delinquents that drank and felt the way I did. Because for me, it was just magic. You take a few pulls off of whatever it is, it's like, oh, I have arrived. I mean, I was 12 years old thinking, if alcohol makes you feel this good, why don't people drink all the time? I don't know. That's an alcoholic thought, I would assume. So I started getting in drink trouble. I didn't know it was drink trouble. I just thought it was unfortunate timing. But, you know, the first time I was to hear the words Alcoholics Anonymous, I was 14 years old, and me and my buddies got together, and we drank a quart of Jim Beam. And I was an aspiring football player. I wrestled for quite a few years. So I was a freshman in high school, and I had this athletic career in front of me. But we chugged this quart of Jim Beam between three or four of us. And then I saw some aftershave lotion, Jade East. Does anybody ever use Jade East? Well, I took a few. There you go. You're not wearing it tonight. I would have known it. But, so I took a few pulls off the Jade East bottle. And one thing about drinking aftershave lotion, it will cure you the first time. So, you know, we went off to the football game, and I was insanely drunk. Alcohol poisoning, for sure. Just crazy drunk. They talk about when you drink, you lose brain cells. Well, I got to tell you, I lost a billion of them or two that night. And so we got kicked out. I was expelled. And my father came with me to visit the counselor at the continuation school. And I'm 14 years old. And he said, have you ever thought of taking your son to Alcoholics Anonymous? And so at 14 years old, it was being suggested that I may want to look into Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, that was 1967. And it wasn't prevalent for young people back then. So just like many of the things that happen in our life, once they happen, you know, the parents kind of, and God bless them, I love my parents. I've got no problems with my parents. But you just never talk about that stuff again. You know, it's just kind of pushed under the carpet. And so I did the things we were supposed to do. And I didn't drink for 6 months. In fact, that was the longest period of sobriety I had before I came back to Alcoholics Anonymous. And what happened when we got taken back, I did everything that chapter 3 in a big book talks about, you know, switched to wine, switched to brandy, switched to beer or whatever. I knew hard alcohol seemed to be a problem for me at the age of 14, so I switched to beer and wine. Now, there's something abnormal to being able to drink the amount of beer that some of us can drink, and, you know, so, you know, I'd do a 6-pack or 12-pack, and that's abnormal. I encourage you to try to chug 3 bottles of water. You can't do it. But something happens when I get alcohol in my system that sets up this. I have never once said, oh, that's enough, I got to go home, or that's enough, I got to go to school tomorrow, got to get home and read that Shakespeare. You know, that was never my experience. I just loved the way it made me feel. And I've never had an off button. I've never said, oh, that's good, I'm feeling it, nah, that's fine, no more for me. I've never said that. And so that night, you know, I'd switch to brandy or whatever. And it just was a series of things. And, you know, scholastically, I was a poor performer. Sports, I was still pretty good. But, you know, when you drink the way I do, you kind of tend to lose it. So I dropped out when I was a senior or before I went back. I was actually a junior and a high school football coach who I had a resentment against, came up to me and he said, you're never going to play on one of my teams again. And I thought, heck with you, man, I'm not coming back. I guess I showed them. But so I went to work. My father-in-law-to-be was a plastering contractor, so I went to work for him. And I was carrying hod and setting scaffold and doing all that. And then I graduated to becoming a plasterer. And by 76, I had my card. And by 78, we were buying a home, my wife and I at the time. And I dragged her through my story, man. I dragged her through my story. And she eventually got sober, Marcy. And then my wife ended up sponsoring, my current wife ended up sponsoring my next wife. And that's an uncomfortable position to be in. But that was many years down the line. I just used to refer to her as that poor woman. But Anyhow, welcome to our Al-Anon friends, too. I also attend Al-Anon up in Tehachapi, and it's a wonderful thing. Monday night, you'll find me in the Al-Anon meeting, so thank you for making that possible. So I'm just a rip-roaring young alcoholic trying to work my way to the top. I had these visions of inheriting my father-in-law's business. The problem is Wednesday. I don't like to show up like Wednesday, you know. I believe I was the one that invented the four-day work week because what happens is I get so drunk on Tuesday night playing cards with my friends is that Wednesday is just terrible. So, you know, I have visions of him beating on the door and I just have these horrific hangovers. It was quite a few years before I figured the morning after drink would get me through that. I suffered through those hangovers, and I didn't know that if I just took a few more shots, I'd feel better. I didn't learn that when I was a teenager, a young man, and that was a lot of wasted years. But as I'm working through it, and I got into this marriage, my daughter Sarah was born, and I remember having the solemn oath that I'm going to be there. I'm going to be the father. I'm going to be the fun father. You know, I'm going to do the things that I thought were lacking in my parents because I thought they were a little stiff, you know. So I was going to be the fun father and do all those things. I made these solemn oaths, but alcoholism kind of crept in. You know how it does when all of a sudden, you know, going out after work is more important than coming home and bringing the paychecks and going to the bar. And I'm just having one at the bar and then closing the bar down. That was a way of life for me. And so, you know, our book talks about we wear our ex-wives, our wives out, and I wore mine out. She just couldn't take any more of it. So she kicked me out, and my feelings were hurt. But, you know, it's her fault. I know it was. But so what happened for me was, I have two older brothers. One of my brothers passed away a couple years ago. The oldest brother is a very successful attorney in San Diego. He's done a lot of stuff, you know, antitrust lawsuits and then I have a younger sister, but my brother was just this incredibly brilliant attorney. And, you know, I would just stand up, so I'm thinking, man, I got shortchanged because this guy is so smart. Everything he touches turns to gold. He just has the ability to go in and make money, and he knows people that are making money, and they're big rollers and all. Now, he would invite me along with his friends for St. Patrick's Day and do that stuff, but I just never felt like I stood up, like I never matched up because this guy is, he's got pictures of shaking hands with presidents and governors, and he knows them by his first name, and I'm just this high school dropout, you know, this guy, and he loves me, but I just feel inferior around all corners. And so we're out riding horses one day on one of these big horseback rides, and he says, hey, how's it going? I said, well, it's not going real good. And he said, well, we just settled some cases, some antitrust cases, and we bought some radio stations. Would you like to get into the radio business? I said, I would love to get into the radio business. And I was just like, yeah. So he hooked me up with these guys, and you know, I went to these little camps, and, you know, I was showing very inappropriate behavior for a new advertising executive, trust me. And I'm fraternizing with my peers far too soon and things like that. But I don't know what it's like to work in an office. I don't know, you know, I just don't get it. But anyhow, I made it, and I was doing some things, and I was a, you know, advertising executive in Yuma, Arizona, which is kind of a stretch, but it's all it sounds like. And so I'm at Yuma, and I'm selling a lot of advertising, though, and I'm doing this because I like it. I like the buzz associated with advertising. I like, you know, you're selling air, and you're doing this crazy stuff, and then they want you to write the commercials, and I'm just terrified because I don't know how to do any of that stuff. But I eked it out and learned how to do some things. But I'm drinking terribly. I am full-blown alcoholic by the time I'm 14. And now I'm in my early 30s and I'm working in an office. I don't know how to treat people. I don't know how to punctuate. I don't know nothing. You know, so I'm there and I'm doing a lot of crazy stuff for the radio station. Somewhere along the line, they said, hey, we're going to get a mascot for the radio station, and it's going to be a 7-foot-tall roadrunner named Scooter. would you mind doing the Roadrunner? And I grew up with the San Diego Chicken, right? I said, yeah, I'll do the Roadrunner. Sure, I'll do that. And they're paying this guy, this disc jockey, $100 for 3 hours. And I'm thinking, well, bring it on, you know? So I start doing these events, and, you know, it's winter time, and it's a 7-foot-tall Roadrunner. It's all, you know, this fake fur stuff, and then it starts to become springtime, and it starts heating up, and it's, you know, it's 110 degrees in Chuma, and it's running about 140 inside of this suit. So I start chugging down a 6-pack or 12-pack, and I go play with the kids, right? And, you know, so I'm moonwalking and just having a ball, man, and I'm having fun doing this thing. I'm having a great time, but they don't pay you nothing. And so I had a resentment about that whole deal, and one time they took me ice skating, not ice skating, there's no ice in Yuma, but it was roller skating, and I don't skate, and I fell over, and the kids picked me up and set me back on my feet, and one of the kids smelled beer on my breath, and he went and told his parents, and the parents called the radio station. The little bastard ratted me off, and so my world is starting to collapse, and I don't know it. So a lot of things happen. Then I end up riding the Buffalo. They told me don't ride the Buffalo. Don't, you know, celebrity Buffalo ride. And I ride the, oh, it was just hideous. But what happened for me was when I was in this place, well, what happened was one day I came into work and they said, well, we got an account for you. I said, what is it? And they said, well, it's a recovery center. I thought, well, that's fascinating. So I sat down and I said, well, what do you recover? And they said, well, we work with people with alcohol and drug problems. And I thought, well, that's fascinating. And I didn't lock eyes with them. So part of my job as an advertising executive was to write these commercials. So I wrote these commercials. I said, I feel helpless and I feel hopeless. And my wife divorced me. I can't keep a job and I can't stop drinking. And the gal I read that to goes, that's perfect. And she said, do you mind recording that? And I said, well, sure, I'll do that. And so I ended up recording that commercial, and I'd been off at San Diego like the whole weekend partying, and it came back over, and FM radio is line of sight. And it came back down over, and headed down towards El Centro, and my voice comes out over the radio. It says, I feel helpless and I feel hopeless. And my wife divorced me, I can't stop drinking. And I went, oh God, now everybody knows. And through a series of bad breaks and misunderstandings, I had a bed in that treatment facility just a couple of weeks later. And the miracle of Alcoholics Anonymous happened for me, and that was in 1987, because a guy came in from the hospitals and institutions committee. He talked about how he felt before he took a drink. That deep sense of inadequacy, like he just didn't measure up. He was never going to be enough. He didn't know how life somehow disappointed him. And man, I identified. This guy had me. He had me. And then he talked about what happened after he took a drink, his inability to shut it down, his inability to take care of it. He couldn't plan. You know, our book talks about it, is that if you find you cannot quit entirely or you have little control over the amount you take, you may be alcoholic. And he articulated that, and he had me. He had me. And you know, he talked about meetings, he talked about sponsorship and get involved in Alcoholics Anonymous. But I know a lot of four-letter words, and help isn't one of them. You know, how do you find these? How do you do this? I don't get it, because I'm not the sharpest instrument in the book, I tell you. And I'm just completely fearful, and I'm toxic. And I'm awful, and I despise myself. I can't stand my own image in a mirror. And so I couldn't say, how do you do this? You know. So when he left, 45 minutes later, I'm drinking a beer, because my girlfriend thought it was a good idea. You know, she said, you shouldn't drink out, you know, hard alcohol, but beer probably wouldn't hurt you. And I said, you're right. What could one beer hurt? And my sobriety, that was March of 87. My sobriety date is December 25th, 1990. So I have a profound respect for the first drink. See, that's the first one that it gets you. I didn't know that until I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was here for a while. I didn't know that. It was the first one that got me. So, over the next several years, things got worse. I like that in Bill's stories. It said gradually things got worse. Well, I tell you, things got real worse. And I'm not going to take you through all of that stuff, but I would find myself living at the lake. I thought I was camping. Apparently, the game warden thought I was doing something else, but So I live an outside lot, and you know, I had grown to the point where I'm walking down the, and my parents were good parents, and I have brothers and sisters that are non-alcoholic, but I'm walking down the street, and there's a woman carrying her child, or walking hand in hand with her child, and they cross the street because they see me coming, because I had grown to that point in my life where I was just disgusting and dangerous to be around. That was their perception. I'm thinking, what happened to that smiley little kid? And so I got arrested a couple times the last time, and I don't arrest well. I don't jail well either. Do we have everybody that jails well in here? Because it's universal. But I get arrested one more time, and I go in front of the judge. Now, my brother's this big shot attorney, and my last name is well known through the court system in San Diego. I never once called him and said, hey, I'm in another bind. Because deep down in here is that I had to own it. I don't want anybody to save me. I'm embarrassed. I'm ashamed for what I've become. So I go into court, and the judge obviously recognized my last name. And I'm standing there, and the guy in front of me is going, I'll take a program. And then the guy behind me is going, I'm doing the time. And I thought, geez, I'm not stupid. I'll take a program. And so I started my journey in Alcoholics Anonymous. Was I came in on a court card. And never once did I think that Alcoholics Anonymous was going to work for me. Never once did I think, oh, those steps, I can't wait to do those. Those are going to turn everything around. Never once did I have that thought. And I came in, and people would go, have some coffee, have some cookies. And after about the third meeting, I'm going, you know, coffees and cookies are not going to cut it, man. I got some real problems. I mean, I got some real, and I am nutso. And so I started to go to meetings, and I started to hear people identify. I'd hear them talk about their alcoholism, because I was a lot of things when I came in here. The episodes of drinking aftershave lotion and all the other hundreds of episodes where I almost killed myself drinking were pushed away. You know, our book talks about I can't recall with sufficient force the pain and suffering last week, last year, two decades ago. And that was my experience. And so I started to hear people identify, and I'd tear a little fiber off, and I'd tear a little fiber off. And all of a sudden, it was the tapestry of my alcoholism. And I began to own it. And I go, God, that's what happens. And these people found a solution. I hadn't worked in a long time, I assure you. And I am getting a job in the shipyards, and my first commitment in Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a secretary for a shipyard meeting. And, you know, doing a lot of taking the San Diego trolley because my car, you know, blah, blah. Moved back in with my parents on several times and several occasions. And when I was detoxing on my dad's couch, I remember just laying there, and it was an old beat up, my couch is the shape of my back. My dad's couch is, so I got a crooked back. And what happened for me when I was physically detoxing, all the disappointment, all the pain and suffering that I caused or potentially caused my children over the years just came back in flows. And I just sobbed like a wounded animal. I just couldn't believe, you know, if there was a God, why would he allow this to happen to one of his kids? And I just sobbed and sobbed. So I came to meetings and I started to show up and do the things. And I started to identify, and I thought, God, that's me. I'm full-blown alcoholic. And eventually I got a sponsor who cared more about my life than he did about my feelings. You probably recognize him, Barney Morris. He's gone to the big meeting. But he got me involved in home group. And I started to take the steps. And some things happened was I started to feel like I was a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because no longer was I alone with these secrets, the things that I wanted to tamp down inside, that I couldn't stand my own image in the mirror. And all of a sudden, I started to feel like a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And he got me in a home group, and I started to act like a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, because I started doing the things that we do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so the journey started. And, you know, I was probably a few years sober, and I went to work for Starbucks Coffee Company. And it was a great gig, man. And I went in as an entry-level position. I was a service tech in San Diego, and there's only like 16 stores. And, you know, the growth that happened after that. So it was, I learned a lot in Alcoholics Anonymous. And my sponsor used to kind of tutor me on what to do in AA. He goes, just suit up and show up, you know. And don't give me any grip, you know, don't give me any guff. And so they gave me a truck, and they gave me the combination to the safes. And people would ask me to go change the combination in their safe. And I'd get in there and go, if I didn't bring it in, I didn't take it out. You know, I learned that in Alcoholics Anonymous. I'd have this safe in there. And so I never once took a penny. And I had plenty of time. And I'm a recovering thief. You know, I like stuff. I like your stuff better than my stuff. But I really do. But not a big thief, just a little shiny stuff. But so I found myself, and I was doing the things. And all I did was bring alcoholics. I did not suffer from... I did not suffer from education when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous or I went to work for Starbucks. So they asked me to move up to Northern California. And I was at a meeting in La Jolla. Not La Jolla, it was Lemon Grove. It was the Lemon Grove Lano Club. Does anybody know that? And then I looked across and I mentioned from the podium that I was going to be moving to Northern California. And I thought I said I needed to get a little tear in her eye right here. Okay, she didn't do that, but it sounded good, didn't it? But anyhow, I asked her for a date, and we went out. And we've been on this road now together for 22-plus years, and it's been wonderful. And so I moved to Northern California, and there was a lot of fear there because, again, I don't feel like a match-up. I don't know how to talk to people. I don't know how to treat people. But through the actions I've taken in Alcoholics Anonymous, I've learned how to behave like a sober member. I've learned how to take responsibility for my actions. Take responsibility, that's a big deal. Give up, suit up and show up and do what they ask you to do. And so I was promoted to a senior tech and then to a service manager. And Anita and I got married, and I was living in a one-bedroom apartment up in San Mateo. And I said, well, why don't you come? And she goes, can I bring Jeremy? And I said, sure, bring Jeremy. And then Jacob, the other son, he flipped his car, and so they joined us. And I'd never heard Anita's story before that, right? And so my perception was the boys are home slinging dope out of the front window of the apartment we're in, and we're sequestered to the back bedroom. And then I hear her story, and I thought, well, gee, I'm living with Ma Barker and the Menendez boys. And she was a wild child, trust me. But that's not my story to tell. And so they joined us, and we started going to Al-Anon back then on occasion. And so we ended up buying a place in 1998. We stayed there, and we never thought we could buy a home. But and then I kept getting more promotions and more responsibilities, and she ended up working for a community in Northern California, and she ended up as the executive assistant to the chief of police. And I still scratch my head. How that happened, you know, it's just unreal to me. But we had all these things. I became a facility manager, and I became a construction manager, and then I was a senior construction manager, and then senior project manager of construction for the Western United States, making far more money. And the only thing, because I came in unscarred by education, the only thing I had going for me was Alcoholics Anonymous, because I learned how to do the right actions in AA. And so we bought a house up there, we bought another house, and we had a fabulous life. And then when things started to turn, we moved back to San Diego, which is where we're originally from. And we ended up losing our house up there in the Northern California. And it's kind of like AA, you think you're the only one that's got the problem. Then you come to AA and you go, oh, geez, everybody's losing their house, or everybody's lost their stuff, you know. So it was that time. You know, we lost our home up there, and I had a stroke in February 2009 that left me blind on the left side of both eyes. So if you see me looking over here, I probably don't see you. But and then what else? And then I lost my job, too. They retired me out. So a lot of stuff can hit the fan. And I tell you, in my experience, it's just time to get on your knees again and resurrender to this thing, to resurrender. And I tell you, that brought me closer to God than anything else, than any success in my life. And I've had a lot of success. It was some wonderful stuff. But ended up walking to meetings and doing that whole deal. It took about 11 months before I learned how to drive again. And in the meantime, you know, when I was a young man, I started playing the fiddle. And, you know, so I'm still playing fiddle and doing that stuff. But so, you know, I ended up going to work for one of our sobriety brothers, Sheldon. Because I couldn't get a job. I mean, nowadays, you can't get an interview unless you can check that education box. And that was always a fear for me. It was like, I couldn't get it because all I got is 11 grades on my books. And really, it was about 9 grades because I burn up a lot of brain cells. And so you can't. So I ended up going to work for Shelton selling cars and doing a lot of different stuff. And eventually moved to Northern California. And just before moving to Northern California, to Tehachapi, I had a son through a different relationship. And I'd spent 20 years trying to rebuild this relationship with Brian. And, you know, I just wasn't there. And when he was about 15 or so, after I was sober, I started to see him again and trying to rebuild this relationship. And it was good for a lot of years. It was really good. And we kind of blended our families. We have Anita gave us 2 boys and their half-brother, and then my daughter Sarah, and you know, we blended our boys together. And Ryan was always kind of like he just got progressively worse. And he ended up coming to AA after he got out of the mental hospital. We brought him, stayed with us for a while, and he'd come to AA, but you know, he was just kind of giving us lip service. I got a sponsor, I'm doing this deal, and it just got worse and progressively worse and worse. And you know what happens to us when we have untreated alcoholism, it can turn into severe mental illness. And so, you know, we moved to Northern California, or Tehachapi. And then, you know, one day I got the message that he had taken his life. And I tell you, it was tough. It was very tough. We'd been working with some psychologists that were in the program. And they said, whatever you do, don't let him come live with you. Because he's, you know, I showed him some documents that he had written to the FBI and everybody else. And they go, whatever you do, don't let him come live with you. And so we were unable to do that. We didn't do that. He would just call and... And he tried to blame it on me, and I'll tell you, the Al-Anon kicked in there, because after a while, you can only make amends so many times. And there's a point in time where you say, you know what, it's not my fault. It is not my fault. We have tried to give you a program, or we have tried to give you mental health stuff. It's just not my fault. And then someone, he took his life. It was devastating, absolutely devastating. But I tell you, the people from Alcoholics Anonymous came and they held us up, and we went to meetings and we sobbed, because that's all we could do. But, you know, for a while there, it was, I went to Northern California because I was having a hard time finding closure with it. And remember, well, you shouldn't let him come live with us. So I go to this meeting. It was my old home group in Pacifica. And I go there and I'm late, and I'm hardly ever late to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I go there, I'm late, and there's one seat left in the whole place, and it's like there. And I sit next to that seat, and there's a little pamphlet on it. And when I was secretary, there were no church pamphlets there. But this one had to do with mental health. And I looked at it, and I opened it up, and it was on dealing with people with mental health problems. And I remember opening it up, it says, whatever you do, don't allow people with severe mental health to come live with you again. And it was, thank you, God. You know, I had to show up at that meeting and see that for it to be fortified and verified. And that's how a God of my understanding works in my life. It gives me precisely the right information at the precise time with the right... It's just astonishing to me. So I found some closure there, and we miss our son. But I tell you, it's a great example of what not to do. You know, this is serious. Alcoholics Anonymous is serious, at least for me. We are not a glum lot. And I love my wife. But as we moved back in, you know, I started playing fiddle with me. And I owed a lot of amends. I know it's hard to believe, but I owed a lot of amends to a lot of people. And one of the guys, you know, I called him up. I said, I got to see you. And he says, okay. You know, I played music with this guy in the 70s, and I almost hurt him to the point where I probably would still be in prison now. I said, I got to see you. And so I went by and he goes, hey, do you still play fiddle? And he said, yeah. He goes, well, bring your fiddle. And so I went and made a face-to-face amends to this guy in Orange County. And, you know, he accepted it like a like another sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. He goes, well, let's play some music. So through this amends, we ended up spending time together, and he ended up having a band, and we recorded some stuff, and it's still playing around the world on internet radio, and we won some awards and stuff. Now imagine if I wouldn't have made that amends, you know. And so my musical career kind of got jump started from that when I went back to excuse me, it's kind of hot up here. when I went back to Tehachapi, I started really studying music because I played for a long time, but I hadn't really studied a lot of music. So I started to learn the particulars about music and stuff. And with fiddle, that helps if you know what you're doing. But so, you know, I'm playing in local bands up there and doing that stuff. Now, I assure you this. About 2 months ago, I had hand surgery, and because my left hand was going numb. And if you play the fiddle, it's really a bummer if you can't feel your fingers. So, I mean, it really sucks. And so I freak out and got a surgeon, got in there, got it resolved. But then about 3 weeks into it, somebody said, hey, would you like you to play with our band for this upcoming event? I thought, wow, that's cool. So I've been playing with these guys. Well, I tell you, if they'd have told me they were going to play Achy Breaky Heart, I would have never done it. So I made a solemn vow, you know, I will never play Achy Breaky Heart. I play the heck out of Achy Breaky Heart now. We're having fun. We're playing a dance, and we're the Mountain Festival's in Tehachapi, August 17th and 18th, and we're going to play for that. So God keeps throwing these little things at me because, you know, for me, it's hope. For me, it's hope. You know, I'm just wondering, I don't know if I'm ever going to play. Hey, you want to play in our band? Sure. My hand is kind of frozen right now, but if you put up with me, I'll play. And so it's just these opportunities. Just when you think nothing's going to happen, then somebody else shows you something, or God shows up in a different way, in a different form, some kind of way. So now, you know, I'm on the mend, and I'm playing pretty good now. And thank God, you know, these little things that keep happening in our lives. We have 9 grandchildren between us. We have blended families. We have 9 grandchildren. We have a bunch of kids. I don't even want to count them, but we blended the family together, 9 grandchildren. And I'll tell you, from blending the family, there's no stepkids in our family. No stepkids. You know, my daughter, I would see her on occasion. Not on occasion. She moved to Texas and brought 3 of the grandkids over there. And I love Texas. There's some good music over there and stuff. But I don't know about you, but I still had some guilt about the kids because I wasn't there. I didn't see my daughter for 4 years. And I was swamped with guilt over that situation. We got to give her a beautiful wedding. I got to walk down the aisle. I got to dance with my daughter. Beautiful picture. A guy came up and he took the picture because we realized we were going through this thing. And the guy took the pictures of the father and daughter dancing with tears in their eyes. Because we knew that it was that minute that we both knew it was grace and it was beautiful. You know, alcoholics, who is it? Norma Alpe used to stay. And so the story was told that they laughed when they're miserable and they cried when they're happy. And they call it Alcoholics Anonymous. And when I heard him do that on a CD, I said, man, that's it. They laughed when they were miserable and they cried when they were happy. And I'll tell you, I'm one happy person as a direct result of this thing. So I'd mentioned to my daughter one day, after years, you know, she calls me Daddy-O. When she wants something, she calls me Daddy-O. And she's 40-something now. She still uses the Daddy-O thing. And we've been there for the birth of the grandchildren. And, you know, we're very active in that. I still told her one time, I still feel bad about it. And she said, don't you ever say that to me again. Don't you ever say that to me again, that you were a bad father, because you have made up for it. I think grandchildren are the great redeemer. You know, if we're, I'm not saying anybody in here was, but I was an awful father. And I tell you, the grandchildren and the opportunity to make things right over a period of time. The big book says there's a lifetime of reconstruction, and a remorseful mumbling doesn't fill the bill at all. We have to take the bit in our teeth. And that's what I've learned how to do in Alcoholics Anonymous, is take the right action, do the things that you know are right, and just be there to support them when they cry, when they're happy, if they're not, you know, whatever it is. And Alcoholics Anonymous has given the gift of forgiveness in our family all around. Our son Jeremy, you know, after we went through the thing with Brian, and I thought, oh man, and it's, the scab is just healing over, and you know, feeling better. Our son Jeremy was diagnosed with Hodgkin's lymphoma, and he's sober 17 years. It was like 15 and a half years then when he was diagnosed, and it was like a gut punch, man. I got to be honest with you. I tell you, I was none too pleased with God. I was none too pleased with anything. I was thinking, how can this happen? Of course, I'm making it about me. It's not me. And he's a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and he's got a God of his own understanding. And Anita had a back surgery at the same time, and our son lost half of his body weight. And he was just terribly ill. Well, he's cancer-free now. And that was such a huge relief, because I was psychotic. I tried not to let my wife know, but I was deeply affected by this thing. But we have never once stopped going to Alcoholics Anonymous or stopped our involvement in AA. And it, for me, it is the place. Man, I come here to get my soul fed. And when I look into your eyes, I see a God of my understanding. I look into your eyes and think, ah, geez, I'm with my people. And, you know, this year, I'm 65 years old. And this year, I got my high school diploma. I was a valedictorian. I guess I'm the poster child for adult school in Kern County. I don't know, but you know, and through that, but I tell you, I learned all I could from perseverance in Alcoholics Anonymous. And now, you know, if I go to get a job somewhere and I really don't want to, I can check that box, you know. But I've learned so much by practicing the principle of Alcoholics Anonymous. Any success in my life, any success, and we've done very well in Alcoholics Anonymous. We've done very well in life as a result of being in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was making six figures at Starbucks, and life was good and sweet. But when all that falls apart, I tell you, it brings me back to my knees into a deeper relationship with the God of my understanding. And I'm so glad that Jim Burwell, he's gone away. I'm so glad he brought that into our literature, that God as we understood him. Because I always liked that, man. Because if you want me to believe a certain way, if you want me to do a certain thing, man, I'm dying, but I won't do that. You know, I'm dying, but I won't do that. And it's just simply ignorance. Just simply ignorance. And I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and came to believe that power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. I'm thinking, okay, and, you know, turning will and life over to the care of God as we understand. I'm thinking, oh, that's it, you know. And I thought, well, who else wants me? You know, where else can I go? Nobody else is saying come over, you know. Come on, spend some time with us, Jeff. I mean, we could have had this meeting in a phone booth tonight when I first came in here. So these principles in our lives are simply amazing. They work. It seems so foreign and so difficult. You know, a lot of times you go into meetings, and there's nothing wrong with this. You know, the only thing you have to change is everything. You know, and when I hear that, it's like, oh my God. But when you break it down, our program is a simple daily program. Have you done anything to better your sobriety today? Have you talked to a sponsor today? Have you gone to a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous today? Have you called somebody who's less fortunate, somebody that's brand new? I tell you, when I was brand new, somebody with 30 days was like a mini-god. How did you get 30 days? or 60, you get 30 days, and somebody was 60 days. How'd you do that? Because incrementally, that made more sense than 8 years or 20 years or 50 years. It was like, oh my God. But I tell you, so if you're brand new or relatively new to Alcoholics Anonymous, the message is I go to meetings and I do these things. I got involved in Alcoholics Anonymous, and you know, when I go to meetings, I feel better. You know, and then eventually you get a job and you do these things and you're reunited with your family and you take these steps and things start to change in your life without nothing to show for it other than the actions you take. And you go to meetings and you got some fear rolling around your brain. You go, oh man, I feel this. I'm so afraid of this. I'm so afraid of this. I'm afraid this is going to happen. And then somebody in a meeting says, you know, I got this fear and this stuff's rolling around my brain. I'm afraid this is going to happen and that's not going to happen. And how does that happen? It seems like God speaks through us. It's very simple. But if I don't go to meetings, I don't hear that. If I don't go talk to people that have gone through all this, then I miss the opportunity. You know, the last thing I want to leave you with was my father. How many of us put our parents through absolute hell? I put my parents through absolute hell, and that's, I wish they'd have gone to Al-Anon because there would have been a little relief for them, but there wasn't any relief. It was just, and I was the wild child, hard to believe. Everybody else was, and I was just absolutely insane at a very young age. And, you know, I'd be gone for months and wouldn't talk to them. And, you know, they probably were waiting to get the same call that we received. So that it's important there. But I put my parents through all this stuff. And my father was a World War II vet, and he was an MP, and I really looked up to him. He was a good guy. Scared me when I was younger, but later I came to love him and respect him deeply for what he did. And he was, he'd had a few strokes, and he was in a nursing home. And I went to visit him one day. And it was the last time I saw him. And we were sitting outside, and the sun was kind of going down, and it was this beautiful light over us, and he'd seen me, he'd seen the journey in Alcoholics Anonymous, he'd seen it firsthand. He used to ask me, how long do you have to go to those meetings? And later on, it was, please don't stop going to those meetings. I took him with me one time to hear a talk, and he just laughed his butt off. He just had more fun. I plug in tapes of different speakers, and Frank J. I let him listen to Frank Jones' tape, and he just laughed. He couldn't believe it. You know, getting kicked out of the grocery line. My dad just thought that was the greatest stuff ever. He was really a fan of Alcoholics Anonymous. And we sat there and we talked, and I felt kind of swamped. I said, you know, Dad, I feel like, he goes, stop it. I don't ever want to hear that again. He said, those people in Alcoholics Anonymous gave his son back to him, and that he was forever grateful for that. So from my dad to you, thank you for my life.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Another round of applause, please.